Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 263. What's a good way to add isolated, reusable functionality to Python classes? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher covers a recent Real Python tutorial about developing mix-in classes to reuse code across multiple Python classes. He describes how mixins rely on multiple inheritance to combine features from different classes, enhancing flexibility and code reuse. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a news roundup, the Python Developers Survey 2024 results, reasons you may not need a Python class, exploring the sharp corners of Python's async IO library, how JIT builds of CPython work, a web-based GUI library, and a project to quickly query your Python lists. This episode is sponsored by Influx Data. Stuck with slow, time series data queries? It's not your code, it's your database. Traditional databases weren't built for timestamp data. InfluxDB was. Handle millions of data points per second, while competitors wait for dashboards to load. When you use the right tool for time series data, everything becomes faster, simpler, and more effective. Stop waiting. Start building at influxdata.com/realpython. Hey there, I've got a quick request. We've created our first Real Python podcast listener survey. We're trying to learn more about you, our audience, and what you're interested in us covering on the show. It's a quick survey, less than 5 minutes. You can click the link right in the show notes on your podcast player, or visit realpython.com/podcast, and the link will be in the show notes for this episode. Thanks. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right, so we got a bunch of news this week, kind of a fun survey to discuss in the middle of that, and then topics and projects as usual. So can't go another episode without some more releases. So you ready to dig in?
Yeah, it's starting to get silly. Frequent listeners will know I've been saying the news was going to slow down for like 5 or 6 episodes now. And this is just a constant reminder of my inability to predict the future. Hire me. I give software estimates this accurate too. So, there nice. You go. All right. So first off, a couple of weeks gone by. So a couple Python releases have happened. First, Python 3.13.7. This is a bug fix release and follows on the heels of 3.13.6 rather quickly due to a regressive defect being addressed. If you're mucking around with SSL sockets, make sure to upgrade as this release fixes a deadlock, which you probably don't want to have happen. Next, Python 3.14 release candidate 2 came out. The original plan was for this to be the last one before the release went gold. And this one was supposed to come out a couple of weeks later than it did, but a bug fix meant that they have to make a breaking change in the PYC files, so they've decided to have one more candidate, or hopefully one more candidate. PYC files from RC1 aren't compatible with RC2, but that's okay because the compiler will figure that out. You don't have to really pay attention, but that's why they had to bump it. Next up is a new PEP. PEP 802 is titled Display Syntax for the Empty Set. Set comprehensions use brace brackets, and that's somewhat problematic because so do dictionaries, which means at the moment, the only way of creating an empty set is to actually call the constructor. So an empty set of braces creates a dictionary, so you've got to use that constructor to get an empty set. What this PEP proposes is a new notation, which would be brace/brace, which would indicate an empty set, thus distinguishing it from two braces for a dictionary. I kind of like this idea. Sets have always been the odd one out,
yeah,
even though they're a base type. So this makes them feel a little more consistent with tuples and lists and dicts and all your good comprehension type stuff. So let's see. I hope this one happens. And now for a bit of community stuff. The candidates for the Python Software Foundation board election have been announced. The election is from September 2nd through the 16th, which is in the future as of this recording, but will be ongoing when this podcast is actually released. So if you're listening to this out of the gate, it's probably time for you to vote. The board's a big part of how our community governs itself. So if you haven't done so, go make your vote happen.
All right. Something that's happening from the PSF is Community Service Awards had come out, and guest of the show and Real Python contributor Rodrigo got a PSF Community Service Award for quarter two of 2025. And he put an announcement up on Blue Sky. So I'll include a link, but he was very excited. Just got awarded the PSF Community Award. This is such an honor. I was at the grocery store when I received this email, and I got so excited I could barely focus for long enough to pay for my groceries. I cannot express how overjoyed and honored I am, and I think it's really deserved. So great job, Rodrigo.
Yep, he does good work. So good job, Rodrigo.
Yeah, yeah. And that takes us to something else that just came out. We kind of touch on this almost every year, Python Developer Survey. The 2024 results have been compiled. This is a joint project. JetBrains does the job of sort of hosting and compiling all the information. And this year, they actually did kind of a interesting thing. They released not only the results, but they had a guest come on board JetBrains blog to talk about and do some highlights about the post. And this is from Michael Kennedy. So I'm going to kind of take a lot of the ideas and stuff that came out of the survey and just kind of overview them, mostly based upon some of the stuff that Michael Kennedy highlighted. Michael Kennedy of the Talk Python to Me podcast and Associated Empire. And it's titled State of Python 2025. The survey shows 86% of respondents use Python as their main language for writing computer programs, building applications, creating APIs, and much more. So what that means is that that's their primary language. They may use some other ones, but Python's their main thing, which is interesting. 50% of Python devs have less than 2 years of professional experience, and 39% have less than 2 years of experience. So we're looking at a pretty large chunk of the Python community out there that are very young and new to the language. Maybe they've used it in university, or maybe they've done some projects and so forth. But as far as like having a job and industry, professional experience, still kind of growing with the language.
Yeah, and it even goes further than that. It's 70% less than 5 years. So
yeah,
like 5 years is about the range where I start to call somebody from junior to intermediate, right? If they're working for me. So, you know, 70% of folks who program in this language would be considered junior at most jobs.
Wow. Yeah. 51% of all surveyed Python developers are involved in data exploration and processing. That's like using things like Pandas or NumPy being the tools that were like most commonly used for this. And it kind of used to be a grouping, the way I used to hear it in these surveys or see it, was that it would be like kind of in thirds of web development, things like Django Flask and so forth, data science, and then sort of a catch-all, another third. But data processing and data science is really now the big pie piece, which is really kind of surprising.
The other part of that that I thought was interesting was the adoption rate of releases seems to have slowed down a little bit.
Yeah, I want to talk about that.
The release that most people are using is 3.12 at 35%. And I do wonder whether that's connected to the data science thing, because it sometimes takes a while for the associated libraries,
yes,
Anaconda and all the rest of that to get up to pace. So if you're using PyTorch or something like that and there's a compatibility problem, maybe you become slower to adopt.
Yeah, I was going to harp on that same ideas there of thinking. It said 15% are running the latest version of Python, so that'd be 3.13. There are a handful of people messing with 3.14, trying it out. And then it was, 83% were not using the current year version, a year older or older. And the reasons were the version I'm using meets all my needs, 53%, and I haven't had time to update, 25%. But I agree that I feel like it has a lot to do with the packaging, especially, again, that big chunk of data science people. I have had problems trying to use a lot of tools and so forth, and I had to install multiple versions of Python to be able just to play with some of these libraries and do that sort of stuff. So it's kind of a bit of dragging feet. And what's funny is Michael has really big thoughts about you guys are losing out on performance. Mm-hmm. There's been so many nice big jumps here. And he actually does a bunch of math kind of explaining about like, okay, well, you're probably wasting a lot of company resources by using these other versions, the memory sizes, the EC2 instances, the processing power and so forth. Again, mentioning web dev being kind of back, which is interesting. I don't know what this is entirely, but Django and Flask, but Fast API was kind of the big mover this time. It jumped from like a 29% to 38%, so like a 30% increase as far as mentioning their usage. But kind of all frameworks were up, which is interesting and makes me think a little bit about like what's happening out there in the wider world. There was this weird tendency of using lots of other services to do web stuff. And I feel like companies are kind of making their own footprints and definitely individuals are making their own tools and hosting. At least I see that more.
I also wonder with some of that stuff, often these things, when we're talking about them, are, you know, 2 or 3 percentage points one way or the other. That could be an error bar.
Could be.
Right? A change in the sampling, who participated, whatever, right? Like those kinds of trends. Let's go back the last 5 surveys. And if every year you're seeing 5% increase, then yeah, that's a pattern, right? Whereas this could just be fluctuation.
It could be. Yeah, it's a jump up at least, which is probably a good sign in some ways. A headline of Rust is how we speed up Python now. Rust usage grew from 27 to 33% for binary extensions to Python packages. Gosh, yeah, we have been harping on this for the last couple of years with things like UV and polars and things like that. So lots of thoughts on the changes to Python and free threading, removal of the GIL. He goes down a real long path about async and that kind of being the future. And that kind of leads me to this set of action items that he suggests for people that are interested in learning more and continuing to grow with Python. His first action he suggests is learning UV. We've harped on that a lot, and it seems to be the packaging tool of choice of late. Again, written in Rust, and you can go back and listen to my Charlie Marsh interview to learn more about some of the stuff happening there. And we'll have lots of resources on Real Python there coming soon. Use the latest Python. We mentioned that, but you know, partly it's a performance thing. You're going to get some benefits there. And we'll talk a little bit more about that today. He suggests learning agentic AI. Again, AI is a controversial topic, but he had some interesting points there that maybe not using the default tool that comes with, say, a chat agent, but like a tool that you pay for, something more like the Claudes or other tools that are out there where you're paying like $20 a month to get consistent stuff and you can choose your model. He suggests learning to read Rust, which I think is interesting. Not necessarily program in it, but be able to understand kind of what's happening with the code and be able to just, you know, kind of parse it in your head. Invest in understanding threading. Again, Python is at this interesting cusp, especially with 3.14, with this idea of, all right, are we going to be free threaded? Are we going to remove the GIL? What does that mean for you as a programmer? What do you have to think about as far as like handling that stuff? And he goes much deeper into that. And then remember that there's a lot of new people in the Python community. So when you're writing a blog post or you're explaining something or talking about installing packages, remember to suggest, hey, maybe you should use a virtual environment here and include the advice that you would think about to somebody that is a junior developer coming into the language, which I think is good advice also. All right. Well, you had a couple other kind of newsy items.
Yeah, we seem to have stuck a article and a discussion in the middle of our news. So gone full Reese's Pieces here. Our next little bit is a piece of news that's been rather popular on the internets. The folks at Astral have announced a new product. It's called Pyx, P-Y-X, and it's a package registry. Astral is the company that's known for the open source products UV and Ruff, and this is their first commercial offering, hopefully allowing them to continue to support their open source tools. Now, you might be thinking, hold on, we have a package registry. It's PyPI. You'd be right.
Yeah.
If the libraries you're using are pure Python, PyPI typically doesn't run into any problems. But if you're using things that rely on compiled libraries, you're kind of at the mercy of whatever got built in the wheels in the registry. And this can get complicated as if you're using things like CUDA or PyTorch, and especially if you need GPU-aware flags for your GPU to speed up what you're doing. So Astral's intent here is to work closely with UV and solve some of these problems. Pyx is in a closed beta right now. You can reach out to them if you think you or your organization might be interested. I'm sure there's plenty of news coming on this topic.
Yeah, when I spoke with Charlie Marsh, We talked a little bit about that, this idea of sustaining the company, of keeping Astral going, this idea of building a company and keeping things open source. How do you keep the funding going? And this was definitely one of the ideas that he had. So it's kind of wild, like all the things that they've been moving on in such a short period of time. I think at the time we were talking about a type checker, now named Ty, and is come out also. So a lot of movement there.
And then the last little bit of news here is we'd like to give a shout out to Brian Aachen, host of the Test and Code podcast. Brian has been hosting Test and Code for 10 years and has 237 episodes. He's decided to focus on other things. So episode 238 is the last one. Yes, it is ironic that a podcast on testing had an off by one error in its episode numbering. Brian will still be working with Michael Kennedy at Python Bytes, so he isn't just hanging up his spurs completely. Lots of good content from Brian over the years, so we'd like to say thank you to him for what he's created for the community.
Yeah, nice work, Brian.
Yeah, and speaking of classy.
Hey, yeah, to dive into topics here, we've been talking about classes quite a bit. In fact, a lot of these ideas I felt were well distilled into this one piece that I'm going to cover this week. It's from Adam Grant on his Micro blog, and it's titled, You Might Not Need a Python Class. So the TLDR here, there are quite a few things built into Python that maybe you're new to the language and are coming from a language that's much more focused on OOP. We've discussed this before in things like Java and so forth, and coming into Python and thinking, oh, I need to roll my own classes kind of for a lot of these circumstances. But Python's been around for a while. We're going to talk about that more going forward. But there are a lot of choices that are ready to go, and you might not need to roll your own. And it may make more sense and be more manageable for you and probably more performant to maybe use some of these choices. So the first one is name tuples or data classes. Often classes are just created to store data inside them, and Python's built-in alternatives to creating a class that just has some things that are stored inside of it. Name tuples are a great choice there, or data classes that came along in Python 3.7 are much simpler and more concise. Both name tuple and data classes are cleaner and automatically provide methods like dunder init and dunder repr, and also comparison methods, again, without you having to add any extra boilerplate to them. Named tuples, you would import them from the collections module, and data classes actually come from the data classes module. And there's code examples for all of these, kind of showing really short snippet examples of like what it would look like if you're building your own class and how you would do it here. Stateless utility functions. So if your class has methods but has no state or no instance attributes, it probably doesn't need to be a class, and you could just use a function. In this particular case, if you're grouping a bunch of constants together, a good choice might be to not build it into a class. If you're just grouping a bunch of constants, maybe make them into a module. And a module is naturally serve the purpose without any extra boilerplate. And building out your own module allows for the reusability there and utilizes namespaces and some other kinds of advantages there. If you're managing state with simple structures, you probably could just use a dictionary or a list. Again, they're going to show some examples in the article to learn a little bit more there. But for simple state management, dictionaries or lists could just suffice. Classes are overkill when you simply just want to store stuff that's mutable. Simple one-off operations. So again, kind of going back to the functions and stuff like that, you could look at using lambdas or comprehensions. And then just, again, general advice here, avoiding complexity, built-in libraries. Python standard library is really extensive. Before writing your own class, you might want to check if one of these requirements that you have is already covered. He gives examples of if you need a custom class to manage, or maybe you want to serialize configurations. Python has a built-in config parser or the JSON module, and that stuff might usually work for those things. So again, kind of a slight detour. This is just another reason for learning the standard library. There's been a lot of these ideas out there of, like, speaking of Rodrigo, he would go in and do these deep dives on these things like iter tools, or we've mentioned func tools many times, or just generally learning what are the data structures that go beyond a dictionary and a tuple and a list and a set inside of Python. You know, why might I use some of these things, and how can they give me the advantages of these sort of already built-in objects ready to go. Kind of wraps up with when you actually need a class. Classes are more powerful and useful, especially when you need to encapsulate state and behavior. Your objects have clear behavior methods associated with their data, so it's kind of that connection between the two. And maybe you're modeling complex hierarchical structures, inheritance, composition, stuff that we talked about last time about choosing between inheritance and composition. Again, often it's in some of the examples that are thrown out there are kind of toy examples. But if you look at some more in-depth object-oriented code, you can kind of start to see, oh, okay, why should I maybe get involved in doing this? So thanks again, Adam.
And we recently talked about similar kind of concepts in episode 259 when we were talking about the maybe you shouldn't be using the Gang of Four patterns.
Yeah.
These kind of things sort of overlap. So if some of this appeals to you, you might want to check that episode out and the links that go with it as well, because it's similar kind of content, particularly if you're coming from something like Java or C#, knowing when and when not to go all object-oriented in Python is helpful.
Yeah. Let me guess. Your time series queries start fast, then begin to crawl as data grows. Traditional databases weren't built for timestamp data like metrics, events, or sensor readings. They crash on high-volume writes and time-based queries. InfluxDB was purpose-built for this. Millions of data points per second, automatic compression, sub-10 millisecond queries. It's like choosing the right Python data structure. Using a list when you need a set works, but it's not optimal. Time series data deserves a time series database. Visit influxdata.com/realpython. So what do you got first?
I've got an article by Laura Sky, who goes by Sailor Lee online. The article is titled Async.io, a library with too many sharp corners. Not sure what happened, but there seems to have been a glut of Async.io content in the last month or so. We've posted a few tutorials in PyCoders. There was Armin's article on Green Threads and this one as well. So there just seems to have been a resurgence a little bit on the internet. Could just be coincidence. If you haven't used it, async.io is a way of doing concurrent code in Python. For a language that touts there's only one way of doing something, we sure seem to have a lot of ways of tackling concurrency. The async and await keywords got added in Python 3.4. That's an oversimplification. They didn't become keywords until 3.5, but neither here nor there. And these allow you to write coroutines. So a coroutine is a way of structuring your code with cooperative multitasking. So if your code needs to wait on something like IO, you give up execution to some other coroutine, and execution control is given back to you when that IO task is done. In theory, coroutines handle this same kind of IO-bound concurrency that threads handle, but being a language feature rather than just a library call, the compiler helps you ensure certain kinds of structures get enforced, which in theory should be better. Of course, one person's easier is another person's why the hell did they do it that way? And thus leading us to Sailor Lee's article and the library's sharp corners. The article has 5 sections, each of which deals with a different corner. Evidently, we've established this isn't a rectangle. The first subsection is titled, Cancellation is Broken. Let's say you're writing some threaded code and something happens on one of the threads that means you need to cancel the other ones. There really isn't a clean way to do this. You can send a pthread kill signal, but this isn't usually recommended as it doesn't consider the current state of the thread, and it might leave you in a bad way. The typical practice to get around this is for each thread to every once in a while check an "Am I canceled?" variable and exit cleanly if it happens to be true. Of course, if you don't remember to use this pattern in just one of your threads, well, you're stuck and you're back to the problem. So thread scheduling is handled by the operating system, but async.io is internal to Python. So Python is controlling when any given coroutine is running. So the good news is each time Python handles a control change, it checks if the task involved got canceled. If it is, it raises a canceled exception within the coroutine. The bad news is it's an exception like any other, and it can be caught and ignored. And of course, you wouldn't do this on purpose, but say something goes wrong in your finally block. Well, the next time the code routine gets scheduled, it just keeps puttering along. It doesn't really, canceled isn't really so much of a state. And so essentially, cancellations can get eaten, and this can lead to hung code and deadlocks. Sally Lee contrasts this with an alternative library called Trio. This library still uses exceptions, but subsequent scheduling keeps the task in the canceled state. For code cleanup, there's an explicit mechanism with a timeout that you can use, meaning you can't accidentally muck it up in a finally block. And if your cleanup code messes up, then the timeout is enforced by the library. So this, in theory, is less dangerous. The article's quite long, very detailed. I'll give you just the titles of some of the other four sections. Section 2 is task was destroyed but is still pending. 3, IO has pointless landmines. 4, async IO queue is difficult to use. And finally, the catch-all, other less major problems. So the article's very pro this Trio library, but even if you're not looking to switch to a coroutine alternative, learning where async IO's sharp edges are and comparing that to other solutions might help you avoid some bodily injury.
My next one is a post by Savannah Bailey, former guest, recently married, congrats, formerly Ostrowski. And she came on the show to discuss the Python language server protocol. It was titled Using PyLance to Write Better Python Inside of Visual Studio Code. She's become a core developer, which is really cool, and is involved in doing some interesting sort of educational stuff on the side and helping with a variety of things. But this one is titled How JIT Builds of CPython Actually Work. The subtitle is You Don't Have to Be a Compiler Engineer to Understand How Your Code Runs in a JIT Build of CPython. So this is a pretty deep dive. I've touched on a lot of these subjects off and on. I've touched on tokens. I've touched on the disassembly module. I'll include a lot of links and I'll kind of try to shout them out as we go. But it's a fairly deep dive because you're diving into the ideas of compilers and what happens inside your code. The piece starts with what actually happens when you execute your code, a brief overview of CPython's interpreter. This is a common thing that we get into, that CPython uses an interpreter as opposed to being compiled like something like C. It starts with the code being broken down into tokens, the smallest units of meaning in your code. She gives an example of a simple function and highlights, okay, well, what are the keywords? What are the identifiers? What are literals? What are operators? And so if you look through the function example, you'll see, okay, def is one of those. ABS is the name of that defined function. Oh, there's an open parentheses, variable defined A, B, the if statement, the operator of a greater than symbol, and so forth, and the return statement. She shares a little program. It's kind of helpful seeing these examples as you go through the piece. She uses the tokenize module from the standard library. You can import tokenize. And this is a nice code example that lists what's going on and prints out everything that would be tokenized separately. And then the code is parsed. Again, we've discussed this a little bit before in the show, episode 207. We talked about an article by Bartosz that was titled What the Dunder PyCache Folder is for in Python. And I also discussed it a little bit in episode 123 with Muradiv Luff. He talked to me about creating a Python code completer and more about abstract syntax tree projects. So at this point, the code gets parsed and built out into this thing called an abstract syntax tree. It creates the hierarchical structure of the code, showing how different parts relate to each other. For example, in the function there, the AST would show that the ABS is a function definition, A and B are parameters, and then the if statement is conditional. This whole flow drawn out as a tree. And again, there's a built-in tool. And what's very nice, you can see in this code example, okay, import the AST, build the tree, include your source text as your parameter there, and then you can print it out. The next step is that it compiles into actual bytecode. This is what the CPython interpreter executes. We mentioned briefly there before this idea of .pyc files. That's something that gets saved on your computer. That's the bytecode that's being created once it's been interpreted and run for the first time. We mentioned this before when discussing things like syntactic sugar, looking into this code of using something called the DIS module. This is the disassembly module, again, in the standard library. So she provides another code example showing DIS to explore the code. The output looks a little bit scarier, but it's still something that you can follow along and see what's happening, especially with the original code next to it. And then CPython runs your code using a bytecode interpreter. An internal evaluation loop executes one bytecode instruction at a time, dispatching the appropriate C function that handles it. And then this is a loop that manages the Python virtual machine, the PVM, which maintains a call stack and handles memory management and exception handling and so forth. Is a little bit of a callback to Michael Kennedy's piece, where he was hammering on the idea of like why you should get on the newer versions of Python. Since Python 3.11, there's been something called the Specializing Adaptive Interpreter. It was a significant contribution to why Python 3.11 was about 25% faster than Python 3.10 for most of the workloads. The simplification of it is that once a bytecode instruction has been executed enough times in a code path, the interpreter can specialize it. And it bases on the types and values seen at runtime. And so that means it can kind of make this faster path for it. That takes us to what we were talking about at the beginning here, just in time. A JIT compiler is a type of compiler that translates code into machine code at runtime rather than before execution as most compile languages. So instead of having run a compiler step, it's doing it for you right at runtime. Okay, so what happens in the build? And that takes us into this area that's called a micro instruction interpreter, spelled out as the micro symbol looks like a little U, ops, so UOPS. CPython is already doing some smart things to optimize your bytecode, and what if you could do it better? What if we could take those bytecode instructions and turn them into something more efficient? And that's where this micro instruction interpreter comes in. The piece then digs into the micro op interpreter and breaks each bytecode instruction into a code path, down into even smaller, more specialized instructions called micro operations. The process of breaking down bytecode instructions into traces, which are these sort of sections of code, happens automatically thanks to some domain-specific language infrastructure that was introduced in 3.12. So again, all these little things that have sped up Python lately. It's effectively a table to look up and say what this bytecode instruction maps to these micro, again, operations. So with Python, the JIT compiler uses a technique that is pretty recent. It's called copy and patch. This is something that is covered in a paper and in a more friendly form in a blog post that I'll link to. But there's a video I'll also include from that's from PyCon 2024. It's by Brant Bucher. And in the talk, he provides some of the details of how they took the ideas that were presented in that paper. Again, this idea of copy and patch. They were working in a language called Lua, these Chinese developers and researchers, and then the team at Python here have looked at applying it and how they could do that in Python. Another real quick note, LLVM is the compiler that we often talk about on a lot of projects lately. The LLVM project is a collection of modular and reusable compiler and toolchain technologies. One thing that always is confusing to me is that LLVM itself is not an acronym. It's the full name of the project. So I'll include a link to that if you want to learn a little bit more. So I'll just quote from the last chunk of the piece here. What happens is as follows. When CPython is built, we use LLVM to generate pre-compiled stencil files for your specific platform and architecture. These stencil files contain templates on how to translate the micro ops talked about earlier, into machine code. When your code is executed, the JIT compiler monitors the execution and identifies hot, that's in quotes, traces, sections of code that are executed frequently. When a hot trace is detected, the JIT compiler takes the relevant micro ops, which are the smaller specialized instructions we covered earlier, and uses the pre-compiled stencil templates to generate native machine code. The JIT compiler fills in placeholders in the stencil templates with the actual values that are going to be needed in your code, such as addresses of variables, constants, and cached results, patching up the code. And then these stencil files are then linked to form a trace, which is a sequence of micro ops that can be executed as native machine code. Finally, the JIT compiler executes this native machine code directly instead of interpreting it. 3.13 started this optional JIT path. There weren't a lot of real speed jumps improvements. In some ways, it was a sometimes a little slower, depending on what they're doing, but kind of they were testing out what these fast paths were and will these techniques of copy and patch work and where are the crashes going to happen and so forth. And it's been this optional flag that you can turn on for a little while. 3.14 should see much more performance. And there's a lot of good links at the end of this piece. Not only Brant's talks on the piece, he talked at the 2023 PyCon, What They Don't Tell You About Building a JIT Compiler for CPython was the name of the talk at that time. And then the 2024 talk is Building a JIT Compiler for CPython. So again, on the same idea. She also includes a link to PEP744, and she promises it's really not that scary. And again, there's a call for people to experiment with it and turn on the flag and try some of these features out. So again, if you're interested in performance or interested in learning a little bit more about lower operations and how all this stuff happens behind the scenes inside of Python, it's a very interesting read and lots of links to grow your knowledge. So thanks, Savannah. It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course, and it's connected to much of the conversation this week about classes and object-oriented coding. The video course is titled Design and Guidance, Object-Oriented Programming in Python, and it's the third part of a series about object-oriented programming in Python, so depending on your background level, you can pick where it makes the most sense to jump in. The courses are based on a pair of written tutorials by Leodonis Pozo Ramos. And the video series is by my co-host, Christopher Trudeau. In this particular course, you learn about the object-oriented approach in Python versus other languages, cases in which you shouldn't use classes in Python, alternatives to inheritance in structuring your code, and the SOLID principles for improving your code. SOLID is an acronym for five principles that you should use when thinking about object-oriented code. The principles are the single responsibility principle, the open-close principle, the Liskov substitution principle, the interface segregation principle, and the dependency inversion principle. Again, this course is the third in a three-part series. Part one is an introduction to class syntax, where you learn about how to write classes and use attributes and methods. Part two is about inheritance and class internals. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. All right, what do you got next?
I'm taking us back to that class topic. I've got a Real Python article called What Are Mixing Classes in Python, which is by frequent contributor Bartosz Sojinski. Trying to keep in mind that 50% of folks have less than 2 years coding, let me give a quick inheritance primer. Typically, you want to write a class to encapsulate some data and functions on that data that goes together. In Python, those functions that belong to a class are called methods. Say you've got a class that describes a car with attributes for the number of doors and number of wheels. Then say I want to describe a truck. I could write a separate class, but seeing as it's going to have a lot of the same attributes for, say, numbers of doors and number of wheels, I start repeating myself. Instead, having the truck class inherit from the car class, the truck gains everything the car has, but can add to what is inside the class, like, say, payload space. This can be thought of as an is a relationship, so a truck is a car in this case. Now, if I want to add a method to serialize both of these objects, I could add it to the car class and the truck class would get it automatically. If the serialization code is generic enough, I might not even have to adapt it for the truck version. Let's add a new class for animals. Clearly, an animal isn't a car, but what if that serialization method could be useful? There are a couple of different ways of handling this structure. One would be to move the serialization code out of the car class and into a pure function. Another would be to create a serializer class that just has the serialization method. Both the car and the animal can inherit serializer to gain its capabilities. Now, you want to be careful with this, as you're creating a lot of structured hierarchy. The danger is now you're relating cars and animals, and that can get you in trouble because they're not really related. Some languages have mechanisms to deal with this specifically. Python more or less handles it by convention. So this brings us to the topic of the article, which is mixing classes. A mixing class is one approach for dealing with this kind of problem. From a technical standpoint, it's an inherited class like any other, but to avoid the cars are not animals problem, we put some limits on what classes do in order to consider them mixins. Like I said, it's a convention, so you may find things in the wild that don't completely follow the entire convention, but most mixing classes have the following traits. One, they usually have the word mixin as a suffix in the class name. gives you a hint that it's a mixin. Two, they're a plain class and shouldn't inherit from other classes. So we don't want to try to get hierarchy mixed in with our hierarchy. They're meant to be drop-ins that provide functionality rather than things that define structure. Again, that structure of car versus animal, we're trying to avoid that. Three, they should have a single behavior, like being responsible for serialization. The idea of a mixin is to be able to mix it in with other classes, so it really should only contain methods that make sense together. That often means they only even have a single method. You can have more than that, but they should be part of a logical grouping. They should make sense together. Four, mixing classes should be stateless, or as stateless as possible. This means there's no need for a dunder init, as they don't have their own variables, or in the rare cases where they do, those variables really should be for exclusive use of the methods in the mixin. For me, this is the really defining trait. Without this one, I wouldn't call a class a mixin. And the last trait is non-standalone. So a mixin that isn't mixed in doesn't make any sense. So back to that serializer example, you need something to actually serialize. This is a Bartage article, so the stuff I've covered has barely moved the scroll bar. The article goes on to give plenty of examples on where mixins get used, distinguishes between mixins and abstract base classes, potential pitfalls of using mixins, and a lot more. So if you want to deep dive into this particular object-oriented technique, there's plenty here to dig into. Mixins are very, very common in the web space. You find them a lot in things like Django. So if you're heading in that direction, it might make sense to learn a little more about them.
My first experience when I was getting back into programming with mixins was with charting and graphing libraries.
Yep.
Which kind of makes sense when you think about these libraries and so forth. They have a lot of sort of reusable functionality that you would want to maybe move from types of plots and charts and legends and axes and lines and bars and so forth. And so that functionality being able to be sort of added in. And so I had never seen the word used before when they were describing the library, but I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, there's literally we're calling it out as mixins.
Yeah. And it's also one of the challenges with teaching object-oriented concepts is usually the simple examples to understand things like inheritance are very bad examples. So, you know, the idea that a square is a rectangle, you know, I can, that helps me convey the concept of inheritance. But honestly, if you're actually going to go build a square, an object to describe a square and an object to describe a rectangle, you probably shouldn't be using inheritance there. So there's the pure, I'm trying to describe structure, but most of the time in programming, you're not completely trying to describe structure. You're trying to describe things that belong together. And in that square rectangle example, a square only has one side, so it really should only have one thing in the initializer, whereas the rectangle, you need to have the width and the height. And it starts to get messy.
Yeah.
And mixins are sort of a way around this because you're separating out those pieces. It technically is still an is-a because it is inheritance, but it's as close to not being as you can get away with in Python. Again, all by convention, but helpful.
Yeah, yeah. The other architectural thing I think of in a lot of technologies is sort of plug-in sort of stuff. The concept of like adding functionality, like an you know, music application or a video application, and these other like pieces of codes that can plug in.
Plugins are almost always has-a.
Okay. Yeah,
because I've got a collection of audio sample pieces that they would be contained inside of each other so that they can operate independently. But the line between where you might use a mixin versus where you might do a has-a starts to become purely how you're writing the code as well. So
sure.
The lines are blurry. So we've got a couple great multi-part in-depth object-oriented courses and one on Solid, which is a design principle when doing object-oriented pieces. So if all of this seemed like, oh my God, that's way too complicated, then we've got some links that can help you out.
All right. Well, I think that takes us into projects. In the write-up that I mentioned earlier, the Python survey that in Michael Kennedy's piece, he referred to a few things to look into, and one was GUI libraries. And he mentioned two that are not ones that have been around for a long time as far as like, you know, been in the Python community. In one, he mentions that I actually covered a little bit a while ago on the show is called Fast HTML. And the other is a library that I'm sharing this week. I've heard of it. I just never got to feature it yet. It's called Nice GUI. That's all one word, N-I-C-E-G-U-I. Its subtitle is Create Web-Based Interfaces with Python, the Nice Way. The project is from Zauberzug. I'm guessing I'm pronouncing that right. I don't know. GmbH, so a German company there. You can see it in action if you want to just kind of check it out and play around with some of their examples. It's at nicegui.io. It's funny that both of these take a web browser approach to doing a GUI library. And what's nice about that in some ways is you being browser-based gives you the ability to leverage a bunch of stuff like, well, you can use CSS then. And so they actually take advantage of Tailwind CSS under the hood, SVG, Markdown. It can act as a web server, so it can be accessed by the browser or used in native code like a desktop window. It's touted as an easy-to-use Python-based UI framework. Again, shows up in your web browser. You can create buttons, dialog, markdowns, scenes, plots, and much more. Good for micro web apps, dashboards, robotics projects, smart home solutions, and so forth. These are some things that they're offering as suggested areas you could use it. It allows for simple grouping with rows and columns and cards and dialogues. Again, a lot of that is coming from a lot of the CSS stuff that's there, which is nice. There's powerful high-level elements inside of it, a plotting of graphs and charts. There's a way to use virtual joysticks with it, annotate or overlay images, interact with tables, even embed video and audio files. So there's a built-in timer to refresh data in intervals every 10 milliseconds. Notifications, dialogues, and menus. You can have shared and individual web pages and then an easy-to-use per user and general persistence. I even had an interesting way of like hosting it that I thought was kind of cool. You can pip install it from PyPI. They also have a Docker image. Again, their site has a lot of examples. And then the README doc site is built from the framework also with, again, lots of additional information. So I'm actually looking forward to playing with this. I like it. It looks like a nice little library to build some projects from. All right. So what do you got for a project?
My project this week's called Leopards, and it's by Mohamed El Kaliobi. This is a neat little library that brings database-style querying to dictionaries and objects. So it's kind of like the methods provided by an ORM, but without the database backend. The example in the project README shows three dictionaries, each with a name and age. You then import the Q class from a Leopards library, passing in a list of those dictionaries and then a dictionary of constraints for your query. If your constraints were name contains K and age is less than 21, what you'd get back is the dictionary or objects that met those constraints. The constraints are structured very much like their Django ORM equivalents. You name a constraint using the name of the key in the dictionary that you're querying upon, rather than the title of the column, and then append an underscore and the actual constraint operator. The supported operators are comparisons like equal and greater than, contains, start with, and end with, all of those supporting case-insensitive versions, as well as in and is null. So that the example I gave earlier of name contains would actually be name underscore contains. And then if the attribute of a dictionary called name had that letter inside of it, then you'd get a match. The library also supports combining different queries together using and, or, and not, as well as data aggregation methods, including count, min, max, sum, and average. If all that isn't cool enough, the name Leopards is well deserved. This is a speedy little beast, often operating an order of magnitude faster than equivalent pandas code. It also works with DictReader as an iterable, meaning unlike pandas, you don't have to pull the entire CSV file into memory to perform the operations. It's by no means a replacement for pandas. It's much smaller and lighter weight, but if the kinds of queries you're doing are covered by what I've just described and Leopards can do it, well, you're going to get a lot more speed for it. So it might be worth a look.
Nice. Well, thanks for bringing all these PyCoders articles and projects this week.
Always happy to be here.
All right, talk to you soon. And don't forget, if you're working with any timestamp data in your Python projects, you owe it to yourself to try the right tool for the job. InfluxDB makes time series data effortless. Whether you're building analytics dashboards, monitoring applications, or tracking performance metrics, join millions of developers who've already made the switch. Get started today at influxdata.com/realpython and see the difference the right database makes. I want to thank Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.